welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we are going to be talking about some of the new data we have on immigration policies in the United States under Donald Trump. And also, of course, we're going to be talking about many of the things that took place coming out of the election in Georgia with a city council member from just outside Atlanta. But before we can move on. Well, they're finally over. The special election swing around the circle was completed last night when Republican Karen Handel defeated Democrat John Ossoff in Georgia's 6th District in the race to fill the seat vacated by Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. That race, which was the most expensive in the history of congressional races, with at least $56 million being spent, was the highest profile in a handful of races around the country. Democrats took losses in Kansas, Montana, Georgia, and South Carolina, although they performed notably better than previous Democratic challengers had in most of these deep red districts. Ossoff had drawn so much attention, principally because Price's district had voted against Trump. Ossoff was something of a dream candidate for the Democratic establishment. Was youthful, good looks, experience on congressional staff. He also assiduously avoided being associated with the party's more progressive wing. That being said, he also seemed to be trying to narrowly tailor his campaign to appear to be about strictly local issues more than anything else, to avoid the perception that he was parachuted in by Democratic consultants and Hollywood stars when in fact he's from the area. Either way, he's still lost, and the idea that wealthy Republican voters will launch a backlash against Trump is still in doubt. All that being said, however, Democrats did do much better than they had in the past in many of these places. In Montana, the Bernie Sanders-esque Rob Quist turned in the best performance for Democrats in a House race in that state for four election cycles. In both Georgia and Ossoff's race and in South Carolina, where the Democrat Archie Parnell lost, both candidates lost by just over 3 percentage points in districts Republicans had been winning for years by 20 to 30 points, which certainly lends some credence to the idea that Democratic voters are energized and that energy could turn into a wave for Democrats in the 2018 midterms. Should be remembered in both 2006 and 2010, right before big wins for the opposition party in the midterm, they lost a handful of special elections going into it. Which brings us to the next question, which is whether or not the results of these special elections, all of which Donald Trump and family campaigned in, helped jumpstart his quote-unquote agenda. Trump certainly hopes so, and more or less said as much on Twitter, urging Democrats to stop obstructing him and work with Republicans, which is, of course, a canard, because Republicans more or less have the votes to do what they want in the most general sense. In fact, the entire meme that Trump's agenda was bogged down was always something of a myth. The Russiagate investigation certainly has been tarnishing him, and for some it appeared he might actually at one point be impeached, putting his agenda in peril, although quite frankly, with the coming announcement of the Senate Republican health care plan tomorrow, it's possible all the focus on Russia helped Trump in terms of progress towards the first major policy issue of the presidency by helping keep it under wraps. Some sort of health care bill, tax reform, and infrastructure plan are still within reach. Undoubtedly, the fact Trump was not so radioactive will also spur Republicans worried about their own seats next year to close ranks around the president to try to push through things they think will be popular with their constituents, which means the partisan battle over Russia, rather than going away, could actually become more intense, which in and of itself is an issue. Democrats have more or less staked everything on the Russia issue. Given that the investigation is still ongoing and probably will be for some time, it risks turning into a Benghazi-like sideshow as Trump and the Republican Congress eviscerate the social safety net and conduct a trillion-dollar transfer of wealth to the richest Americans. The Democrats as a brand don't really have much to recommend them, so much so in some races the National Party tries to stay away to avoid the candidate actually being framed as a Democrat. So perhaps the Democrats will get lucky and Republicans will push through a good piece of their agenda, which is incredibly unpopular. Just don't expect them to lead any effective resistance on their own. And we mentioned the issue of extreme heat yesterday and how one-third of the planet's population was now at risk because of it. We wanted to briefly check back in on that issue because we have recently learned that the heat emergency in Arizona is so bad, planes can barely fly out of Phoenix Airport. Yes, that's right. It's too hot in Arizona for planes to fly. 38 flights out of Phoenix were canceled before the heat even reached its peak yesterday, and temperatures as high as 120 degrees could linger in the Southwest into tomorrow. One Arizona meteorologist noted, Arizona has seen a significant increase in the number of days where temperatures hit 100 degrees plus in recent years. In Tucson, for instance, the number of extremely hot days has increased 55% in the last 30 years. According to roughly 20 different scientific studies, the rise in extreme heat is one of the clearest examples of climate change. So clear, in fact, that more or less defined the issue for years back when climate change was referred to as global warming. Yet the Trump administration continues to blunder on, pursuing every type of dirty energy possible and eliminating environmental regulations left and right. What sort of future may that portend for humanity? Well, as it concerns heat waves, we know from the author of a recent study that, quote, dying in a heat wave is like being slowly cooked. It's pure torture. Looks like we got lots to look forward to. We had reported to you about the Sandra Bland Act that was before the state legislature in Texas fairly recently. Well, to update you, the law was passed and signed by Governor Greg Abbott last week, however, in a reduced form. As reported by the Texas Tribune, the law in its final form, quote, mandates county jails divert people with mental health and substance abuse issues towards treatment, makes it easier for defendants to receive a personal bond if they have a mental illness or intellectual disability, and requires that independent law enforcement agencies investigate jail deaths. However, elements of the bill dealing with policing were stripped out in the state Senate version of the bill. As originally written, the bill would have required, quote, additional proof for stopping and searching vehicles and prevent arrest over offenses that could be handled by a fine, end quote. So ultimately, the bill became more of a mental health bill than one dealing with the issue of abusive policing practices that were what led to Sandra Bland being sent to jail in the first place. So while undoubtedly the bill advances the ball in terms of trying to improve conditions inside of Texas's county jails, it doesn't reduce the number of people there unnecessarily. The bill did add in more de-escalation training for police, but as we've seen around the country, this is not terribly effective. As you might expect, one of the key factors in the bill's defeat ended up being the fear of major opposition from law enforcement groups or organizations who had already expressed some concerns. What a surprise. The police standing in the way of any legislation that could possibly require them to respect human rights. And to circle back around a little bit to where we started, there is one more thing on the whole issue of Trump being back on track that we alluded to, and that's the idea that Republican priorities are not that popular and could drive a backlash. Well, as it concerns the Republican health care plan, a new poll by the University of Maryland seems to back that up. The poll found that 63% of Republicans in deep red districts dislike the House-proposed American Health Care Act, AHCA, legislation. Looking at the poll overall, which took a look at people's attitudes, not just Republicans, towards individual provisions of the plan, doesn't look much better for the Republicans, that is. 80% of people opposed the provision to allow higher premiums for seniors. 77% opposed any waiver that would allow insurance companies to deny coverage on the basis of pre-existing conditions or charge higher rates for a pre-existing condition. That includes 60% of Republicans opposed. 65% of people opposed repeal of the essential benefits provision that covers things like mental health care. 55% say cuts in Medicaid spending are unacceptable. 53% say repealing the expansion of Medicaid is unacceptable. And 57% say the repeal of health care taxes on the wealthy is unacceptable. Which dovetails from some reporting from the New York Times' Nate Cohn, who in March noted that the changes in tax credits and increases in premiums will probably hit many deeply pro-Trump areas the hardest. So in other words, the Republican health care moves are very unpopular, could actually hurt their own constituents, perhaps even the most. So don't be surprised if the right to health care becomes a major populist quote-unquote issue over the next couple years. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we switch gears, well, slightly, by Khalid Kamau, who is the first Black Lives Matter organizer elected to public office in the country. He's on the city council, the inaugural city council of South Fulton, Georgia. Also worked with the Fight for 15. Been a field organizer, working in a number of different capacities, and also a Bernie Sanders delegate this past year. So a great CV. Khalid, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. I'm impressed. It makes you sound like I've done a lot.
I hear you. Well, that's always good. That's always good when you've got so much going on that when you hear it, you're like, oh man, I have done a lot. Focused on the work, and I appreciate that. So I wanted to just start with the big news in your neck of the woods, which was this Georgia 6 special election. You know, there was a lot out there. You are from Atlanta. You've been there. You've been rooted. I mean, are you surprised at the result? Is it more or less what you expected? Maybe some top line thoughts.
No, I'm not surprised, but I'm still disappointed. Back when, during the Democratic National Convention, I led a walkout of nearly 1,900 delegates. It wasn't just me, a bunch of brilliant people. Scott Miguel from California, Miguel Zuniga. But we led this walkout before the nomination of Hillary Clinton to try and dramatize the fact that if people nominated her, that there was going to be this literal walkout of voters. And we had this chant that said, you know, a vote for Hillary is a vote for Trump. Nobody believed us. Turned out we were absolutely right. And even there was even a point where I was surprised. You know, Hillary had rented out the Javits Center. I wasn't totally a fan, but, you know, as a feminist supporter, I was excited about having a woman president. And, you know, I kind of bought into the hype around the end. So I was excited. So I was a little disappointed, but it was what we predicted. Similarly, you have in John Ossoff a candidate who ran a lot like a Supreme Court nominee. No one knew that he was even a Democrat until the runoff. We had what was called the jungle primary. So all of the different, you didn't have to like vote on the Democratic side and then on the Republican side. All of the candidates were there together. Lots of people didn't know that John Ossoff was even a Democrat. Didn't run as a Democrat, didn't champion any progressive issues, you know, outside of supporting Planned Parenthood, because liberals have become so ashamed to be liberal that now supporting Planned Parenthood is a cutting edge progressive issue. So that says something about where we're at. And so, yes, $30 million later, the outcome wasn't very different than the other four special elections that have happened since Trump, where Republicans retain power. I mean, you look at specifically Montana, right? You know, this guy's punching guys in the face. And that was Montana, right?
Yeah, Montana. Body slammed the guy, Greg Gianforte.
Body slammed the guy, right? Body slammed the guy and still won. Like, and there's only like a 2-point difference between that race and John Ossoff's race, where we spent $30 million. Mm. We spent $30 million for two more points and still losing. So I think my hope is that now that we have spent millions of dollars running middle of the road candidates, that perhaps there are two thoughts. One is that we can stop chasing long shot races and find some races where we actually have a good possibility of winning. Right? And that we can focus on winning places that we know that we can win, because I think we just need some wins to build the momentum. And then the second thing is that I hope the next time there is a big race that we'll give the progressive candidate a chance. You know, we've tried in all of these big national races to run these candidates that don't offend anyone, and we lose. And the thing that I admire about Republicans is that they will be as anti-gay, anti-choice, anti-government subsidies as they want to be. Like, they don't care who they offend. And they are rewarded by winning elections, because the truth is that resonates with people. That, like, whether I agree with Trump or I don't agree with Trump, like, at least he speaks his mind, whatever his mind is that day. But, you know, at least he speaks it. Right. And he doesn't apologize for it.
No, I think it's a, I think it's a good question, and I think it's one that we'll see, or not question, but set of points, that we'll see appear again in Georgia probably next year in the gubernatorial race. I mean, I think that Stacey Abrams, who I'm sure you know, Rel, has sort of raised a similar issue, around in the South and other areas. Why are we chasing people who, you know, aren't progressive, who are against a lot of these issues, as opposed to trying to speak to issues that, you know, a lot of the people who don't vote, but are progressive actually care about?
Right. I worked for Leader Abrams, and I think that she is amazing. She's brilliant. She's probably the best fundraiser in the South. She's one of the best Democratic fundraisers in the country. The question is that when she runs for governor, will she run as a progressive?
Mm.
Because the narrative that is out there now is that the South is so conservative, so you can't be too progressive and run for office. And like this is a perfect example. Donald Trump, as polarizing as and divisive as he is, came to that district to stump for Karen Handel. Bernie Sanders came to Atlanta at least two times in the past 6 months. Mm. Never was invited, as far as I know, to go. I never saw him knocking doors or doing any events with John Ossoff. Barack Obama, former president of the United States, probably has the highest approval rating of any politician right now, never came and knocked doors for like John Ossoff or did any campaign events. Like like those people weren't invited. They weren't invited. But and there really is a frustration, right? So when Leader Abrams runs, is she going to run on a progressive record, or is she going to, you know, try and run it this moderate, I can reach across the aisle, I'm willing to work with anybody. So right around the end, there was a vote. They tried to pass this, like, ALEC-authored Opportunity School Districts bill that would have turned over control. It would have turned control from the school board over to someone that was appointed by the governor. It was really, and particularly in Metro Atlanta, it was a land grab. We've seen this happen in Tennessee and New Orleans to disastrous effect, right? Where the entire public school system is taken over by this private corporation, and everything is run like a charter school, and let's do everything like a business, right? And the effects are disastrous. So we beat back that bill. The governor came back with a modified version of this constitutional amendment that didn't require a vote of all the people. It just required a vote of the Republican-controlled legislature. And there wasn't a lot of Democratic opposition to it. And I think that's because many of our Democratic leaders are now planning to run for governor, right? And so they're trying to show their willingness to work. Yeah. But what has made Republicans so successful these past 10 years is them showing their absolute willingness to not work with Barack Obama or any Democratic president, right? We saw that when he was trying to pass health care. He spent 2 years getting all of these concessions. They made over 100 concessions to Republicans,
right,
which ultimately weakened Obamacare, which is everything that is dysfunctional about Obamacare now, because it is not completely functional. Everything that's dysfunctional about Obamacare now, most importantly, the elimination of the public option, were concessions that we made to win Republican votes.
No, it's true. Well, we're going to take a quick break on that, but we're going to come back with more on this here on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing to talk about some of the deeper implications flowing out of what happened in the special election in Georgia 6. And we are very, very happy to be joined by Khalid Kamau, who is a city council member in South Fulton, Georgia, along with a number of other superlatives. And I wanted to turn here and ask another question that I think is relevant, something that you brought up, which is, I think, sort of crucial for quote-unquote progressives in America, the idea that the South is just like this impenetrable fortress actress of reaction. You know, I'm happy to not only be from the South, but a city where Bernie Sanders did win the primary handily, but that's an aside. Nevertheless, you know, it does seem like people are so willing to just write off whole areas of the country without very little experience. I mean, certainly the right wing is very strong there, but when you look at, you know, the number of people who vote gerrymandered, I mean, there's all these sort of subsidiary issues, but it does seem to some degree that if you're sort of a progressive in the South, you know, it's difficult to get as much love nationally. Like, I feel like everyone, for instance, should know who you are, who's a progressive, you know what I mean? But, and if you were in, you know, I don't know, St. Louis, we'd all know who you were, you know what I mean? But it's a little slightly different when you're in the South because of people's perceptions, I feel. I don't know your thoughts.
Yeah, I think we got to work on that because unless the progressives are going to try and reform the Republican Party, we're in a two-party system. So until we have a third option, progressives are going to run in the are going to run as Democrats. I mean, you can in a local race, in a state, maybe even in a state race, you can run as an independent, you can run as a third party person. But to really get ballot access, to really win enough electoral votes, right? So until we change ballot access laws or eliminate the electoral college, you really can't escape this two party system, right? So we're going to have to take over the Democratic Party. It's time for us to have like some tough talk and some honest conversation. Unless you just find $1 billion to mount a 50 state strategy for ballot access for a third party, which no one has been able to do yet, we're going to have to take over the Democratic Party. And no Democrat is going to win. No one's going to actually win the presidency of the United States without winning Southern states. Southern states have 137 electoral votes. So at some point, you gotta win the South. And no Democrat is going to win the South without winning people of color. So what we know about voting habits is that African-American women vote Democrat. First of all, they vote more consistently than anyone else in America, mm-hmm. more than white men, more than Asian women. African-American women have the highest voter participation rates in the country, bar none, period, every election. And they vote overwhelmingly Democrat. 85% of them vote Democrat. So the first thing that you need to do in order to win the South is make sure that you're winning the hearts and minds of black and brown people. Unfortunately, in our last two, you know, in our last election cycle, I think not Bernie Sanders himself, but his overwhelmingly white political machine kind of gave the black vote to Hillary, who then took it for granted. Mm. So like neither one of them really worked for those votes. And those votes were the tipping point. Those votes were the reason Barack Obama became president of the United States. So that's A. I think your election, whatever your electoral strategy is, it has to include winning the hearts and minds of black and brown people and not assuming that because you're a Democrat that people are automatically going to vote for you and not assuming that people won't vote for you. I tell you, one of the best ways to get black and brown people out to the polls, and we learned this in Barack Obama's campaign, is to have a black or brown candidate, right? If the base of your party is now people of color, then your leading candidates and your party leaders and your party leadership should probably all be people of color. Like, your party leadership should look like your party base. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that Republicans do differently, which is why they've been winning elections, even though no one was supposed to, white people were not supposed to be populist enough to, you know, Donald Trump's strategy of going after working class white voters, there weren't supposed to be enough of them to win an election. And they proved us all wrong. The second thing is that we've got to do a better job at the local level of showing that progressive policies work. At this point, our country has become so regressive that there are not a lot of places that are progressive anymore. And most of them are your Seattle, your DCs, your New Yorks. They're all places where the average median income is multiple times larger than the rest of America. And most of them are also overwhelmingly white. And so when you're in a rural or suburban southern place where you have a lot of voters of color, they all think a $15 minimum wage sounds nice, but it can't work here. That only works in like Seattle and San Bernardino, right? But it is actually working in Clarkston, Georgia, they passed the $15 minimum wage for city employees because we have these Republican preemption laws that prevent us from raising it or mandating that for non-governmental employees. We can't make businesses raise their minimum wage here. But we can do it for city workers. We can do things like decriminalizing marijuana for less than an ounce. So we can change it from an offense that you were jailed for to just an offense that you were ticketed for. We can't legalize it, right? But we can change the way that it's prosecuted and penalized. And there are tons of little progressive changes that we could make on the local level, right? Which is why we've got to focus on these city council races and these county commission races and these school board races and these state house races that no one pays attention to. When you go to the voter booth, you don't even know who half the people are. But we've got to pay attention on those and change those, because what happens is that we scale up.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I'm doing in South Fulton, which is, at its inception, the fifth or sixth largest city in Georgia. I'm pushing a lot of these policies. And then when people see that they can happen, right? When we can decriminalize marijuana and it doesn't increase like drug use across the spectrum, because that didn't happen in any city, right? When we do that, people can say, oh, well, maybe we can do this in Atlanta, which is larger. And if it works in Atlanta, then maybe we can do it for the whole state of Georgia. But right now, we don't have a lot of, when you look around the South, there are not a lot of places where progressive policies are being enacted. And we can say this is a test laboratory for progressivism, because what we do instead is find the biggest race, the biggest, shiniest object that we can, whether it's the governor's mansion or a congressional seat, and we throw all our money into that, and then we lose, and then we're left with nothing.
Mm.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly a good point. And I'm glad you actually raised the issue of the decriminalization. And also, by the way, shout out to Mayor Ted Terry of Clarkston, Georgia, who's been kind enough to come on the show a couple times. I'm glad you brought that up, because as someone who was involved in the movement for Black Lives in Atlanta and perhaps in other places as well, and who's now on the city council, I mean, this kind of is the question, and a lot of people certainly have, are what types of policies and things like that are people trying to put in play in a concrete way to deal with the issue of police violence? I mean, obviously you mentioned the decriminalization of marijuana, but now that you have this perch as a city council member, I mean, what are the things you're looking at in that realm?
Well, another thing that we're going to do is we're going to look at the policies, right? Police, when they are policing, can only enforce the policies that are on the books. So if we have ordinances and policies that are anti-people of color, anti-working class folks, then if you eliminate those, then the police can't harass people of color, working class folks. But then the second thing is ensuring accountability. As a city council person, I get input on who our police chief will be. That's one of the reasons that I was actually excited to run in this city. Besides the fact that I was born and raised here, I was spending a lot of time in Atlanta with the Atlanta chapter of Black Lives Matter. We were protesting a lot of policies and political figures in Atlanta's system. And then I realized, well, we're building a city from scratch here, and every law that we're trying to get changed in Atlanta, we can just write it here in these new cities. If you go to, and this is like, I want everyone that is listening to write this down and go to platform.m4bl.com. That's platform.movementforblacklives, m4bl.com. You can see scores of recommendations that have been compiled by Black Lives Matter chapters and activists and allies from across the country on a variety of different topics. It's not just police violence. We've talked about doing a speculation tax to stop these rapid transfers of property, of rental, of homes, for example, that become rental properties,
mm-hmm.
for bad renters, right? And they also like raise property values in neighborhoods. It's part of what happens in the process of gentrification, right? So there are policies in place to talk about gentrification, to talk about education, to talk about, you know, police brutality and all of these things. And so there's a whole list of them, and I'm going to enact as many of them as possible in the 4.5 years that I have in my term. And it's really, because, well, one thing you understand is that the city of South Fulton is 89% African American, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is a black city. So these policies are, and it's a working class city. We have a median income that's $10,000 less than the city of Atlanta, which is right next door. Mm. So these policies benefit people. I'm not just enacting them just to enact them. But then the second thing that it does is that it allows people to see that there is another way of governing, of being governed, of living. So that, again, it's about building. It's about building an argument that can be scaled up.
Well, and I'm glad you touched on the issue, the working class character of the city, and I know you've been a rank and file worker yourself. I mean, how important in the South, especially, I think, you know, even in the context of right to work, not just the importance of workers' rights, but the importance of really trying to find some way somehow to push forward the labor movement as a base for progressive politics. I mean, obviously, I guess the rest of the country, but certainly in that area.
You know, I was just talking with someone, a Democratic Socialist of America. I'm a proud Democratic Socialist. And labor, well, first of all, I mean, for obvious reasons, income inequality has just really gotten out of hand in our country. And the only institution that is large enough to actually combat corporate forces, right, is organized labor. And perhaps educational institutions, right? But if the Koch brothers write a $4,000 check to my opponent, who can write a $4,000 check to me, right? And the only people that can do that are you. And they supported me in my campaign. It is undeniable, even though they're, you know, people love to point out these examples of unions that have been dysfunctional or unethical, but in mass, in whole, unions are the reason that we have a 5-hour work week. I mean, a 5-day work week and an 8-hour work day. And for people of color, when you talk about how do we bridge the gap between, you know, white liberals and people of color, the best way to do it is supporting organized labor, because many fields now where we still have organized labor, we still have representative labor and unions, they are populated or overpopulated by people of color. You know, machinists, service workers, transportation. I was in the ATU, so they're the transit union. They represent, you know, your SEPTA and your MTA and your Metro bus drivers. A lot of those positions are populated by people of color. So that when you support workers' rights, when you support unions, you are supporting higher pay and benefits for jobs that are populated by people of color. You're supporting people of color, and you're also supporting working class folks. And so I think that is one of the best bridge building techniques that you can use when you're trying to, how do we outreach? How do we show people of color that we care? You protect their jobs and you fight for their jobs. And then when you do that, you end up with a union that can write $4,000 checks. $4,000 is the maximum individual contribution, right, that you can accept in Georgia, right? But I can get, like, $4,000 checks from every union and I have enough money to run a race.
Well, I certainly think that's a very valid point, very interesting point there. And let me ask you this on a slightly – maybe more hyper-local level to Atlanta, but I'm very curious about this overall process of the creation of some of these new cities. And South Fulton, as we've mentioned a couple times, is a new city. I know that there's some other places in the Atlanta metro area. But reflecting a little bit on St. Louis, where there's, outside of St. Louis, all these little cities that were formed out of these counties, I mean, do you have any fear that it also could end up driving inequality, segregation, certainly from a housing standpoint and so on and so forth, as maybe rich people try to also wall themselves off a little bit to others as more and more working class folks are forced into a lot of these suburban areas by gentrification?
Oh, definitely. That's exactly what is happening, mostly in the South, right, or in these conservative states. Rich enclaves, they are forming their cities ostensibly to have more local control. But what it's really about is taking their tax dollars out of the pool of everyone, because in many states, and again, these amendments, the American Legislative, whatever that stands for, ALEC, a lot of these are copy and pasted constitutional amendments and resolutions that they have created for conservatives that they use, that they just spread around the country. And one of them is this idea that all of the tax dollars that are raised in a city limit have to stay in the city limit. So if me and my 100 wealthy neighbors turn our subdivision into a city, then all the tax dollars that are raised in that subdivision, which is now a new city, stay in that city, which means that the only people that get at the schools in the area don't get it unless they're in that subdivision. The streets don't get it. The cops don't get it. Right. So all of these services that you expect government to provide become defunded in general and funded only for a specific group of people. That is what was happening in Georgia. In the county that I actually live in, there is now only 5 square miles left that are not incorporated. And they're probably going to come into the city of South Fulton. But there's no more unincorporated county areas. And now the next county over, DeKalb County, they're going through the same thing. And what usually happens is that, as I said, these wealthy enclaves incorporate and become cities. And what happened in our case is that we chose not to do that and to stay with the county. But as the last unincorporated area, all of the cities around us began to then annex all the valuable parts around the edge of our city. And so we were left with less and less, with a shrinking tax base and less money to fund ourselves. So we had to incorporate just to retain control of the lands that we had left that hadn't been annexed by other places. So in some ways, it can be a good thing. If you are in an underserved community, you incorporate, you can get more local control depending on what state you're in. You can have like more local control of your police, maybe your school. And so like that is a good thing. But ultimately it is it's just leading to the balkanization of America. We're just breaking into smaller and smaller parts, and people are being selfish and not sharing their resources. And the whole point of government is to pool resources so that we can have more as a whole than any individual or small group
mm-hmm.
have. So it's a concerning trend. But if you're in a place where wealthy enclaves are already doing it, then you better do it.
Right.
You have to do it.
Right.
And you form a city as large as you can with as many resources as you can so that they don't form some small city and take them all from you.
And that's what we're going to have to leave it for today. We're going to take a break here, but that was Khalid Kamau. He is a city council member in South Fulton, Georgia. You can check out his website at Khalid Cares, KHALIDCARES.com, KhalidCares.com to find out more about him and some of the things that he is doing. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, today we're talking a little bit more here about some of the implications coming out of police violence in America, which is a very relevant issue because right now, as we are doing this show live, there is breaking news that jurors found Dominique Keegan Brown, who shot and killed Civil Smith on August 23rd in Milwaukee. That was the case that set off the Milwaukee uprising that I'm sure many people remember from last year, I guess it was. So nevertheless, a lot big news here, and coming on the wake, the Philando Castile thing, just another acquittal that I'm sure will roil the nation. We're joined by Bob Schlehuber, who's a Sputnik News analyst, and Sean Blackman, who's done a lot of work in the movement for Black Lives with the Stop Police Terror Project, to discuss this and some of the things coming out of it. Gentlemen, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, Sean Blackman, here we are yet again, just days, really, after the officer who killed Philando Castile, and the footage was released as well, the dash cam footage, I believe, this morning of that incident. Geronimo Yanez, gone free. Now Dominique Keegan Brown, also gone free. I mean, it really is just, I don't know. I don't know if we can be surprised anymore at this stage in the game, but it's still outrageous in my view.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was looking at the fact that the Philando Castile footage
and what it showed contradict how the officer portrayed it. I think of what Kwame Ture Stokely Carmichael told us when he said that capitalism doesn't lie some of the time, it lies all of the time. And since the police act as the armed wing of the capitalist state, it is absolutely imperative to that system that they're protected at all costs. This is why they're able to lie, steal, and kill with impunity. And I may have said this on this program before, is that the reason why you don't see the punishment of police in this country in proportion to their crimes, if at all, is the same reason that, you know, you don't see teachers punished for teaching or bakers for baking or firefighters for fighting fires. You don't punish people for doing their jobs. And when the police kill black people, when the police kill brown people, when the police kill people with mental health issues, and when the police kill homeless people, when the police repress people in working communities, they are doing what they are put in place to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very relevant point there, Bob. I mean, this Officer Yunez in the Castile case, I mean, basically lying throughout the thing, and also his defense throwing in this whole issue of marijuana, of weed in there, why I smelled burnt marijuana in the car, as if that would be something that would make you think you needed to pull a gun and shoot someone. I don't know. Last time I checked, most people aren't worried about stoners killing them in some random traffic stop. I mean, so even the fact that I'm bringing it up, that was taken as like a legitimate excuse, like, oh, well, you must have been smoking weed, which, you know, we don't know. It just shows the unbelievable just abdication of any semblance of justice in a lot of these situations.
But for me, I think it really tells us that body cameras and the whole movement around body cameras and what was a win for the movement a year and a half ago wasn't a win. They don't matter. The video of Philando Castile from start to finish, from the police officer in the car telling the other police officers he's going to pull him over because there's a wide set nose and he looks like some other person that had just committed a robbery. He lies there. He lies when he tells Philando Castile why he pulled him over, that his brake light was out. He lied to him. That wasn't the real reason. He was profiling. He then said to the other police officers, now after he had shot Philando Castile, that Philando Castile was reaching for his gun and he had told him not to reach for anything, even though in the video it tells him, can I see your license and registration? He lies again. So at every single moment on tape, which we have recorded, which a year and a half ago, people would said, oh my God, if we just have on tape these police officers lying and then doing these things that aren't justified, we'll finally get justice because we'll have proof. Now we have it and we realize that nothing at all has changed.
Yeah.
And it does not matter. There is no justice in this situation. Same thing now in Milwaukee, the same police officer. We have the footage. We have them seeing the chase that he shouldn't have shot him. He went against protocol. And so again, if you're caught on tape, not following protocol, it doesn't matter. And that's what I think is really shocking, because we saw the extreme. I mean, this tape from the Philando Castile tape is heartbreaking. And it's even more, it's even more heartbreaking now watching that his girlfriend got arrested after Philando Castile got shot and was put in the back of a police cruiser with her little daughter. Like, that's crazy. What good is this for our society?
Well, I mean, and the wild thing is how you can hear Philando Castile on the tape saying, I wasn't reaching, like, before he bleeds out and dies. And it's just so many different levels. I mean, it's a great point that you make there, too, in regards to the body cameras. I believe it was DeRay McKesson actually tried to say that having the video somehow had done a better thing. But, I mean, it raises two other questions in my mind, Sean. One, you know, the standard, and this is the body cam issue and why the camera doesn't matter, because the standard that's established by the Supreme Court for police shootings is very high. It's essentially, did the officer, did a reasonable police officer in a general sense, would they have thought at the, would it was it reasonable for them to think their life was in danger? And I used to always say, we always say on the show, that's too high of a standard, which I think it is. But now I almost feel like to some degree, it kind of speaks to exactly the reality of policing in America, which is what is reasonable is these completely ridiculous shootings, and that we've built up a society that says the police should have the right to kill you first with no due process if they, for whatever reason, subjectively feel that they are in danger. I mean, we've sort of set up this whole other system. But the other thing, too, to speak to that and how systemic it is, the cop that killed Philando Castile, Latino guy, and the cop that killed Civil Smith in Milwaukee, black guy, similar situation. And I think it just shows how institutional and structural this is. But speak to that, please.
Yeah, well, a few things. In terms of the body cameras, I think it goes to show how in movement work, every achievement isn't necessarily a victory. Clearly, we see that the proliferation of body cameras have now really only given us a front row seat to our own execution. And I've almost reached the point where I just don't think I'm emotionally capable, frankly, of watching anymore. Mm. It's just not natural to see that much death constantly. Now, in terms of the race of the officers that are killing these people, I actually saw an article that suggested that, you know, Yanez killing Castile was an example of what they called, you know, anti-blackness against in the Latino community. And I think that's sort of a misdirected analysis. We always have to bear in mind that you don't have to be white to be in service to white supremacy. If we look at the case of Freddie Gray's death,
The entire history of slavery. But sorry, just wanted to note that. Well, I don't know why this is so crazy. People, oh, he was black. We can't be racist. And like, so was slavery not racist because white slave masters had to use a lot of black people to enforce discipline on the plantation? Like, that's absurd.
Right. Well, no. And to your point, it speaks to a profound misunderstanding of what racism is in general. Mm. People look at it as a superficiality. But of the six officers that killed Freddie Gray, three of them were black. So when they did this, were they functioning from, you know, quote unquote, internalized anti-blackness, or were they simply functioning as people of color in service to an institution that is racist by its very nature? Mm. And I would argue that it's the latter.
Well, it's the same thing. I feel like that happens in the military, right? Everybody has the same haircut and everybody's taught the same protect your brother at all costs and everybody has the same mission. I mean, you are stripped of your own individuality. It doesn't matter if you're the nicest, greatest, all of the best intentions when you join the police force. Once you become a police officer, you are inundated in a culture that has no oversight or any restrictions on making sure that you protect power and whiteness and capital at all possible costs. So it doesn't matter what color skin you are. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. It matters that you have that blue uniform on, right? And I think that's what we're being faced with, and that's where the ultimate conversation has to shift because, yeah, like you said, that's completely distracting if people are talking about anti-blackness within the Latino community.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Sean, one other thing here, and I want to switch gears and touch on a couple other things, but I want to just raise this, too. I mean, you know, the one conviction we did have was Michael Slager and the death of Walter Scott, and it's because they brought those federal civil rights charges. Now, that's a high burden to meet, too, but, I mean, it does seem to me that, again, we have to talk about Holder, we have to talk about Obama, we have to talk about who was the second attorney general, Loretta Lynch, and their inability or their unwillingness, I would say cowardice, to charge some of these people because some of them, it's difficult to meet civil rights. But you look at this situation, if you got Slager, you have the guy say, I stopped him because it was a wide nose. You're in the city Falcon Heights where I think the NAACP there said 80 to 90% of all stops are of black people. Castile himself had all those tickets, 50% of them just thrown out on their face because they were obvious, like, harassment-based tickets, that this would have been perhaps even a more clear-cut case than Slager for the violation of the civil rights, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, you know, when I think about Obama and his response to racist police terror, which happened quite a bit under his watch, funny enough, racism didn't magically dissipate because a black guy got elected. I think of the fact that he put together that policing task force and the fact that that task force was headed up by the former police chief of Washington, D.C., whose name was Charles
Ramsey.
Ramsey, thank you. Now, Charles Ramsey, this is the same cat who cost the District of Columbia millions of dollars in lawsuits, also a black man now, cost the city millions in lawsuits because he ordered his officers to assault peaceful protesters. So now you're going to put that guy in head of the task force that's supposedly supposed to talk about, you know, excessive use of force and policing across the nation. So I think from that right there, we can see how deep Obama and his regime, you know, thought about this whole issue. And the only thing that came out of that was another what I call a wet water report. It just tells us, yeah, there's racism in the police departments and all these suggestions that won't get enacted. You
water
see what
is
I mean?
Indeed wet.
Yeah.
That's a nice metaphor there.
No, and thinking about the city, it's as much as it's the city of Washington, D.C., that it cost the millions of dollars, it's the taxpayers. So the only people that are held responsible in these murders are individual taxpayers. In Falcon Heights, Minnesota, no police officer. I mean, the guy lost his job. Oh, my God. Tough day at the office.
He'll probably be a cop in some other place soon enough.
Fraternal order of police will have a mopping floors of the local union chapter and save them. But that's going to cost the taxpayers of that city $4.5 million. The only people that are going to face any punishment or any repercussion are the taxpayers of that city And what good's that going to do? Well, that's Bob, not going
to
bring
me,
back.
Let me turn it back to this. Speaking of also that and the issue of politics and speaking to these special elections to some degree, and who the Democrats are looking to motivate in so-called resistance. So in South Carolina, where Archie Parnell lost to Norman, the Republican special election. Let me just read you. And this comes from an article by Steve Phillips in Democracy in Color. It says, Ralph Norman won by a mere 2,836 votes in a seat that Republicans won by 56,000 votes last November. More important, the winner in South Carolina got just 44,000 votes, but there are 132,000 eligible black voters in that district. The Democrats could have picked up that seat without getting a single white vote, which of course they would have had they invested in, communicated with, organized, and inspired the African-American electorate. But instead, they ran a guy who is an old white man who spent a significant amount of his adult life living in Switzerland working for Goldman Sachs. Now, whatever, he was making some good points. But like, how are you that you got 132,000 eligible black voters and this is what you do? I mean, it just shows to some degree the bankruptcy of the Democratic Party, that they would rather cater to racists who wouldn't want to see a black candidate as opposed to try to inspire the 132,000 black voters that they could have turned as an organizing arm.
I mean, it's simply, we remember from the John Podesta leaked emails, they said, do not, whatever you do, all Democrats across the country, do not support any policy items presented to you by the Movement for Black Lives. Have we seen a statement or press release by the Democratic Party since that says to change that order whatsoever? And all they have to do is come out and say whatever they want. The black community has shown up more than any other numbers. Black women vote in higher percentages for Democrats consistently. All they have to do is come out and say, whatever Movement for Black Lives, here's our new policy platform of the Democratic Party. You got it. And they haven't done that. They haven't even given, oh, okay, you know what? This policy we can do. This one's too. They haven't even sparsed through it to see which ones they could and maybe can't support and where they can compromise. It has been nothing. That is why I think it is a joke to say that the Democratic Party is going to reform. The Democratic Party needs to be taken over. The Democratic Party needs to be this and that. No, it's silly. It's a fool's errand to continue to push the Democratic Party to change when they've completely fought it and they're losing more races and they're still not coming out and saying they're going to change anything.
Sean.
Yeah, I agree with Bob. You know, this is just another example showing that this so-called resistance from the Democrat Party is a complete farce. They sort of come with, you know, supposedly progressive rhetoric, like they're going to be moving to the left or something. But I mean, you know, so that's why they're like, you know, trotting around Bernie Sanders. And that's why, you know, they gave Ellison the little consolation prize with the DNC.
Trotting around Bernie Sanders, a guy that want to go to the South and meet with black voters, which cost him the election himself.
Right.
Like, why is that your solution now?
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, even going back to like, you know, the DNC convention itself, I mean, you know, they had like Boys to Men, you know, performing on stage. I mean, they did everything except I thought they're going to have a fish fry outside the doggone venue to try to just wheel black folks in.
I might
have
stayed longer after I was in the
case. You and me both, but you know, be that as it may.
I was just waiting for Hillary to break out the hot sauce. I was like, what's up, girl?
Just keep it in the bag, right?
You know, hey.
But you know, Democrats are just showing again that they have absolutely no intention whatsoever of reaching out to black folks and to the progressive voting elements that they completely lost and shunned during this last election. And these are the same folks that they will also expect and really probably try to berate and to browbeat in supporting them when they put up Cory Booker or whoever else is coming down the pike in 4 or 8 years.
And part of it, I guess I just want to say, part of it needs to be, then that's fine. That's fine. They don't have to. Stop expecting them to. Stop letting them pander to you and just say, fine, you guys have your thing. We'll have a Republican Party, and then other people on the left will set. What would be wrong with having three parties in America? People talk about like it would be, oh my God, the whole thing would collapse. We need this fine balance between Democrats and Republicans. We just need to unite as if they speak for anywhere near all of the electorate. 90 million people did not vote. Clearly, there needs to be another party, and this whole Democratic thing, like, oh my God, we have to unite under a Big Ten if we're ever going to beat the Republicans, is not a real narrative, and they're clearly not willing to build the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's 100% correct. The one other issue that does merit some attention here, Bob, in none of these special elections did the Democrats make a huge deal about Russia, which is interesting because on the Hill, the people who are actually in Congress, they can only talk about Russia. So it seems interesting that the congressional leadership seems to feel this is a winning issue, but the people running the campaigns seem to feel like it's not something that's going to motivate people.
You know,
I think it's a very telling statement, I think, about what they're doing in Congress.
No, I just think it's a good national, international, big mainstream media story that gets a lot of clicks. If it does, I mean, I think a lot of these newspapers are losing a lot of readership and they're over focusing on Russia. And so I think we'll see it's slowly dying out at the national level, but at any local level, no, people care about health. They care about education. They care about property taxes. They care about their local businesses. To try to get Russia up there and really think that's going to be a winning issue, it's not. And yeah, absolutely hurts them. If they can't find a consistent narrative that they're able to use across the board, they're never going to be a united party, and they're never going to beat the Republican Party, which is the most united party by far in this country.
There's no doubt about that. The party discipline amongst Republicans is definitely impressive. They're much better at closing ranks and, to some degree, much more ruthless. I don't really know what's going on over there, but they certainly have a slightly better secret sauce. I mean, I guess we're just going to have to see. I guess the big underlying question behind all of this, quite frankly, and our entire discussion that we had here today is, if the Democrats do take back the House in a wave election, what will that port? What kind of stuff will they promote? What will they put in? When it happened in 2006, really wasn't as transformative as I think a lot of people had hoped that it would be. And then they come in, Obama comes in 2008. You got the Senate, the House, and the presidency. They don't really do all that much. So I think the real question is do they try to pay lip service to win a wave election in 2006, the same way they used the war in Iraq, cynically.
And then they lose all the seats 2 years later, 4 years later. I mean, what difference does it make? They can come in there with all their own Democratic policy, and they're not going to stick. I mean, that's the problem. As much as Barack Obama came in there with what people thought was a progressive platform, none of it's sticking. It's slowly unwinding. It's slowly being manipulated by these larger forces that are outside of any one political party's control. And they're going to lose again. Unless there is a radical policy platform by another party, we are not going to see true, meaningful change to basic issues of poverty and racism in this country.
No, I think that's a good point. And as an earlier guest on this show actually pointed out, where was Barack Obama in some of these special elections campaigning? Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and we will see you next time.
By any means necessary.